Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to focus on insects today and zero in a bit on your houseplants. You know, if you've got insects on your houseplants, you can have some problems with those plants. PJ Leash back with us again. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. It's always great to have PJ come by and talk with you about insects of all types. We're zeroing in, as I said, on houseplants a little bit, but we'll take other questions as well and photos as well, too. You can email us your photos and questions at ideas@wpr.org, or you can phone with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Welcome back, PJ Leash.
Pleasure to be here this morning, Larry.
Great to have you here. Now, if you've got some houseplants, I have some houseplants, it doesn't look like they look really healthy. Mm-hmm. But what are some signs that you may have an insect problem with your houseplants?
Well, I'd say the first thing is just simply noticing insects around. There are some of the insects that can be associated with houseplants, like fungus gnats come to mind right away. Well, you'll just see these little insects flying around in that general area or maybe going to the windows nearby. So clues like that, pay attention to. Other things that can fly would be insects like white flies that mm-hmm. are a very bright, brilliant white color, just like a white sheet of paper. And they often flutter around rather clumsily as well. So keep an eye out for those. I would caution there are some of the insects and houseplants that can be harder to pick out because they blend in. Some, like our scale insects, don't really look like insects. You're not going to see legs and antennae sticking out. They look more like little brownish blobs kind of glued in place on the plants. So those are harder to identify if you don't know what they are. But something you can keep an eye out for is honeydew. And that's basically sticky sugar produced by scale insects and aphids and things like that. And so if you look at your houseplants and they have a glossy kind of sticky appearance, that's another clue you may have some insects there.
And I imagine, I'm certain that there are different ways to treat depending on the insects.
Oh, exactly, yeah. And that's the most important thing I'd always emphasize to folks. Figure out what you're dealing with first. Once you know that, then you can hop on Google or other things and find some good information out there. One of my favorite resources is by my counterpart in Minnesota, Jeff Hahn. He recently revised his indoor plant insect fact sheet. And so if you Google search Minnesota and indoor plant insects, you should be able to find that pretty readily. And that'll run you through the whole idea of what insects might you bump into, how to deal with them. But you're exactly right, Larry. Got to do different things for some of the different insects.
And speaking of that, Rebecca in Madison has a question about one. So let's go right to Rebecca. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. So I've got scale issues, and I've asked at every place, how do I get rid of them? And most just look at me sadly and say, throw them out. I tried the smaller plants. I just can't get rid of it. And I've got some 20-year-old plants I'd really not like to kill. Is there anything that will get it? I've tried all the chemicals.
Okay. Well, a couple thoughts on the scales. One of the first things is physical removal. And that can be kind of putsy, tedious work. But in theory, these scale insects, they kind of glue themselves in place. If you went around with something like a little pen knife and actually flip those off from the plant, you could physically remove them. That's going to be a lot of work. It's going to be time consuming. But if you have a high value plant, thinking of something like a big aloe plant or something like that, that might be a possibility, is physically removing them off. Sometimes you might be able to scrub them a little bit and get them to come off. Another thing is with scale insects in the adult stage, so they glue themselves in place, they're not mobile, so they can't run away from predators. Their defense tactic is protection. And so they are covered essentially with this leathery, waxy, armored protective covering. And so a lot of the insecticide sprays, you spray it on them, it doesn't get through that armor.
Yeah.
So with that said, there are some insecticides that work better. There are some houseplant insecticides that contain the ingredient imidacloprid. And that one, if you went to a garden center, hardware store, it's probably going to have the term systemic on the package. That is when you actually apply to the soil, or sometimes it's in little spikes that you push into the soil. And the thought is the plant will absorb it through the roots, and it's going to move up within the plant. And that's one way to get to those scale insects, because a lot of the stuff you can spray on them just doesn't work at all.
Yeah. Have you tried those, Rebecca?
I have, the systemic granules. They seem not to absorb very well, so it's hard to tell if they're working, and I'm still finding scale on the plants and the honeydew all over.
Okay. I mean, one thought about that. If you kill the scale insects, it's not like they're going to fall off the plant right away. And so that could be one thing that's going on is it might have actually worked and killed some of the scale insects, and they're still attached to the plant. So that might be something to keep in mind. Otherwise, I would maybe try some of that physical removal. One other thing, so in the adult stage, these scale insects can't move. They can move in the smallest juvenile stage. So when they hatch out of the eggs, the juveniles, we actually call them crawlers, because that's the life stage, it actually crawls around. They would look kind of like mites, just these teeny tiny little moving things. If you keep a close eye on the plants, if you're scouting for, and if you see the crawler stage, and one thing you could do to check for that, if you can put some clear sticky tape on part of the plant, if that's possible, and the crawlers will get stuck to that to help you monitor. If you see the crawler stage, those ones are susceptible to the spray on insecticides. Even something like insecticidal soap, you can kill them. But once they hunker down and get to that armored protective stage, the sprays don't work against those. So if you can keep an eye out for the juvenile stage and target those, you can kill lots and lots of the juveniles. And if they never make it to the adult stage, we kind of break up their life cycle, and that might be a helpful approach too.
All right. Give that a try, Rebecca. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. Mike in Lake Mills emailed to say he knows gardeners are told it's best to prune shrubs and trees in winter, but he believes there are a fair number of good insects like bees which winter in trees and shrubs, and you might be cutting those shrubs down where they're those limbs where they're hiding. Winter's when it's safe to prune if you don't want to destroy those insects, or is that pretty much impossible? Maybe impossible in some way.
Yeah, it would be tough. There are definitely some beneficial insects that can overwinter potentially in trees or shrubs. When I think of the wild bees that would nest in a place like that, I'm thinking of insects that like to essentially nest in a hollow tube of some kind. And so I would think of things more along the lines of hollow plant stems from like grasses and plants like that. Sometimes, and I've seen this on like rose bushes, you might notice where you've pruned off a rose bush previously, that kind of center pithy part has been tunneled out. There might be insects in there. It could be beneficial bees, could be parasitic wasps, things like that. You know, if you see evidence like that where the end of a twig or branch has been hollowed out, that would be a sign that there's an insect living in there. You could still potentially prune those out. Often they don't go in that far. They might go into the twig or branch, maybe 3-4 inches, give or take a little bit. So in theory, if you prune that off because you wanted to do the pruning, and winter can be a very good time for pruning your plants, you could take those prune materials and kind of set them aside in a spot where it could give those insects a chance to come out the following spring.
Okay, that makes good sense, as a matter of fact. Catherine sent a photo of an insect. I don't know if you're seeing it there. It's a pretty insect, kind of oval in shape with, I'd say the top third is black, and then the other two thirds are kind of a green with a black center to that green. And she photographed it. She found it in her kitchen counter last fall, photographed it, took it outside. She thinks it's cute the way it seems to have a picture of itself on its back, and that's very true.
So this one is the juvenile stage of one of our stink bugs, and this is a native species called the green stink bug, and it gets that name because the adult stage, they're about 3/4 of an inch long or so, they're entirely neon green. And so if you see a stink bug that's entirely green, that's going to be the adult stage of this species. The juveniles look very, very different, though, as we can see in this picture, Larry. They're black. They've got some orangish red kind of on the neck region, if you will. We'd call that the pronotum, technically. There's some green kind of stripes on the abdomen. So it's a cool-looking insect. Looks very, very different, though, from the adult stage. I see a lot of these, especially midsummer onwards, so late summer and in the fall, and that's a time of the year that I get lots of reports of these, especially outdoors. They're plant feeders, so they might be a little bit of a concern in like an orchard setting. They can damage apples and some other fruits and veggies and things like that. But overall, a common insect.
And Catherine found it last fall, just as you probably would have predicted last summer or fall. Dick emailed to say he has a 2-inch-long bug that crawled out of an ice hole on Long Lake in Chippewa County, wondering about it. Crawled right out of an ice hole.
Yeah, so if you're out ice fishing, you're probably not expecting things to come out of the hole other than fish you're catching. But there are some of our aquatic insects that can be active at surprisingly low temperatures. And this one in the picture is one of our largest insects in the state. It's called a giant water bug, family Bellastomatidae. It's probably one of the species in the genus Lithocerus. And these can be very common. You can bump into them year-round in theory, because if they come up through the ice fishing hole, you might see them. Also during the warm part of the year, they can be good flyers and are attracted to light. So I've seen them pop up at sporting games and gas stations in rural areas, things like that. I will state this is probably one of the few insects I don't like to pick up with my bare hands. They are predators. And you know, if they're 2, 2.5, maybe pushing 3 inches long, they can feed on things like small fish, frogs, maybe even small turtles. If you were to pick one up and it bit, it's not going to be a pleasant experience.
PJ Leash, our guest today, as we take a look at the world of insects. We've talked a bit about household pests that can attack your house plants, and other questions as well as we move along. Some great photos as well. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us with your photo and or question at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer for the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of insects today with PJ Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Give a call at 800-642-1234 with your insect question. Or if you have a photo you want to ask about insect-related, you can go to ideas@wpr.org. Mike in Chicago has something for us. Mike, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, so my girlfriend has an addiction to plants, and it looks like last summer we had a whole bunch of spider mites that moved in. It's been a 6-month struggle, but I can't seem to get rid of them. Is there any fast or quick, cheap way to get rid of them without using chemicals?
Okay. So a couple thoughts about spider mites. Spider mites in general really tend to thrive under hot, dry conditions. So for outdoor plants, if we have a rainy year, in general, I don't see as many reports. If it's a dry, droughty year, I tend to expect more cases of them. With indoor house plants or plants that started outdoors and were brought indoors that maybe have some spider mites, if they are kept under dry conditions, and especially this time of the year, the humidity's pretty low indoors.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good conditions for them. There are luckily some ways to deal with them. There are some more traditional insecticides, but also things like insecticidal soap, in theory, can kill them. And so that's often an approach I suggest to folks when they contact me at the diagnostic lab, is try the insecticidal soap first. Now, you have to understand its limitations, though. It's only going to kill the mites that you directly spray with it. And once it dries, it's basically done working. So you have to be thorough with your spraying. Another thing is it's going to kill the adult or juvenile mites that are out in the open and actually get sprayed, but it doesn't really affect the eggs. So often what happens is you spray today, you knock down the mite numbers, but there's eggs there and those may hatch tomorrow, 3 days from now, a week from now, or so on. And so all of a sudden, 2 weeks from now, you got another batch of mites. So often I suggest try spraying today, wait several days and monitor the situation and spray again to get those new mites that emerge out of the eggs. And you might have to do that several times. I mean, just kind of a war of attrition if you're siphoning off those new mites and they never make it to the adult reproductive stage. Eventually, we can win the battle.
And insecticidal soap, if you're, you know, people concerned about chemicals in the house, what's the dangers point with those?
So very minor, and that's a great question, Larry. So insecticidal soap, if you were to chat with a chemist, it's almost the same thing as like a Dawn or a Joy dish soap. I mean, it's soap when you look at it at the molecular level. Some of the differences, though, the insecticidal soap doesn't have the colors and fragrances and moisturizers that are often in dish soaps. Sometimes you could, in theory, try a dish soap, but sometimes houseplants might not react very well to some of the moisturizers and scents. So the insecticidal soap doesn't have those extra ingredients. And one other note I would mention about soaps and some of these other indoor plant sprays, it's always best to try a test area first. Sometimes a certain plant just doesn't agree with a particular product. And so if you test a small area and realizes it causes some discoloration, that's better than having sprayed your entire batch of plants and having them all affected.
Mike, does that help out?
Oh, yeah. You guys actually answered all the questions that were in my head without me having to ask them. So, yeah, thank you, Doc. Appreciate
it. All right. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to Julie in Eau Claire next. Hi.
Hi. Can you safely spray a house to keep carpenter ants out? And are there ants besides carpenter ants that leave that sawdust? And then what is the best product to use if you do have carpenter ants?
Yeah, they're little piles of sawdust?
No, what it was, it's an unfinished addition to an old farmhouse, and it used to rain in there a little bit, this door leading to the outside that isn't used at all. And I took a rug away from it. And there was like a row of the stuff, and I had read that a row of the stuff from inside the door. Mm-hmm. And now I had put down liquid taro, which it says isn't for carpenter ants, but a whole mess of black ants did come out, and I killed them the rest of the summer with that liquid taro. So I don't know if I have carpenter at all, but I don't want to risk it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are a number of approaches to go after ants. There are certainly some insecticide sprays, as you just kind of alluded to. We do have some baits. Now, often with carpenter ants, in my opinion, carpenter ants can be kind of picky eaters. It's hard to find a bait that reliably they go to on a regular basis. Sometimes you put out, liquid taro, which tends to be a sugar-based bait. Sometimes they may feed on it. Other times they may walk right on by and ignore the stuff. Sometimes they like more of a protein-based bait. There are a few baits out there specifically designed with carpenter ants in mind, but you're absolutely right. When you look at just the label instructions on some of those products, they may not list carpenter ants. Doesn't mean it won't necessarily work. And in your case, you put it out, they went to it. That was a good sign. My overall thoughts on the situation. So it sounds like there may be some potentially water-damaged wood around that door frame in there. And carpenter ants do like those types of settings to set up a nest. So if you know there's water-damaged wood, one of the important things might be at some point to remove that damaged wood and replace it. If we get rid of the soft wood, they really don't have an interest in good, hard, sound wood. So if you replace the wood that they like, that can be a very helpful step. Otherwise, if it doesn't seem like they're nesting in the house and maybe sneaking in from outdoors from a rotting tree stump or firewood pile, something like that, if you can track down where that source is, maybe that firewood pile, and deal with it directly, that would be another way you could stop it. Otherwise, there are some insecticides that can help. I mean, some of the things from the hardware store are from the pyrethroid group. If you look at the ingredients, they tend to end in the letters THRIN. So permethrin, bifenthrin, cypermethrin, lambda-cyhalothrin, and so on. Those can work. The problem is they can have a little bit of a repellent property. And so if you spray an area, that may force the carpenter ants to come out somewhere else.
Oh.
So that can be a challenge. Otherwise, If you do have major carpenter ant issues, if you contact a pest control company, they have some non-repellent products. And what that means is they can apply it. The ants don't realize it's there around the door frame and things like that. They keep crossing it, and that can work very, very well to deal with carpenter ants.
But, the carpenter ants didn't cause the problems with the wood to begin with. That's correct, isn't it?
Right, right. Yeah, they don't get in and start causing problems. But if you have some soft wood, that's good conditions. That may attract them to the area.
And that's why it's important to get rid of that soft wood.
Yeah.
Yeah. Julie, I hope that helps.
I put a lot of this ant dust because I had heard, I think it was Phil Filateri once said it's best for them to walk through the stuff, then they carry it back to their nest. So I put that down all over, too.
Yeah, there are some products that rather than being a liquid spray, it's a dust or a powder type formulation that can be helpful for nooks and crannies. You know, if there's a gap near the edge of a door frame and you can kind of puff the stuff in there, you're absolutely right. If they walk through it, they may be able to track some of that back into the nest, and that may kill some of the additional ants that are there. So that can be a useful approach, but if you're trying some of these approaches and it's just not working very well, then it's maybe time to try one of the other approaches.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much, Julie, for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly here as we talk insects with PJ Leash. And let's go to Gary in Ween next. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Larry. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
I would like your guests to comment on Phil Laws used to talk about our Wisconsin winters and our below zero is sort of a firewall for a lot of invasive species. And I live in north central Wisconsin. We haven't had a below zero night yet. And I just talked to a friend of mine in Hayward this morning, and he said they've only had one or two nights and just barely below zero. And so I wonder how these warming winters and lack of sub-zero temperatures are going to impact invasive species moving in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And one of the problems is there's so many invasives when you start to look at it that they're all going to be impacted differently. Now, my general thought is it depends a bit on where the invasive insects come from in the world. If they are coming from parts of, say, Western Europe or Eastern Asia that are at similar latitudes to us and are used to our climate, they're probably not going to be affected all that much. They can withstand some fairly cold temperatures. If we have milder winters, that may help them out, expand their range. We do have some other insects that are maybe better adapted to a warmer climate. And if we had, you know, a traditional nice cold hard winter where it would get down to 0 degrees or colder on a somewhat regular basis, that may help keep some of those more southern invasives at bay because they just can't tolerate it. With milder winters, though, if that trend keeps going, I suspect we'll see more invasive species potentially trickle in from like Illinois and south of us. And kind of work their way up. So I know Phil used to joke, you know, the governor would moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. Well, that is kind of playing out. And I've seen that at the diagnostic lab, not necessarily invasive pests, but some other insects like carpenter bees. If you go south of us a couple hundred miles, carpenter bees can be very common. In the last few years, they seem to be getting a fairly strong foothold in the southeast corner of the state where we have kind of our mildest, warmest temperatures. And if the trends continue, I think they're going to keep spreading throughout the state.
Gary, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Kenneth called to ask, what has caused there to be so many stink bugs in the state lately?
So another great question, and the stink bug I want to bring up is one in particular that happens to be invasive. So this will tie in well with the last caller, but the insect I'm discussing now is an invasive species called the brown marmorated stink bug, and it's originally from parts of Asia, got into the country in the 1990s, and that's when we first detected out in Pennsylvania, and then it showed up in Wisconsin in 2008. So in the grand scheme of things, it's relatively new. It's only been in the state for a decade or so. However, the first few years were very, very quiet. Not many reports, maybe one or two reports in a given year. Once we got to about 2014, that's the point where these isolated stink bugs, their numbers had kind of built up enough, we hit a tipping point, it seems, and their populations have really started to take off in some portions of Wisconsin. And so that's why areas like Dane County, Madison, down to Janesville, were one of the hot spots. We see lots of them there. Another hot spot, the greater Milwaukee and Waukesha area, southeast Wisconsin. And then a third hot spot is the Fox River Valley, Fond du Lac up to Green Bay area. I get lots of reports from that part of the state. If you get outside of those three spots, I'm not getting that many reports over all of these. Now, give it 5, 10 years, 20 years, they're going to spread around almost certainly and get to more locations in the state. But the reason we're basically seeing these come up in the last couple years, it's something that's relatively new in Wisconsin.
Well, I was thinking back to Garden Expo last year when I was giving a little talk and somebody found a marmorated stink bug. An audience member said, "Hey, here's one right here. We were just talking about them." Oh, boy. So they're definitely Dane County and many parts of the state and perhaps destined to many more parts of the state. Marcus in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. I was calling. I was just listening to the Carpenter Ants, and I trying to get a solution for that, but I actually have a war currently being waged in my driveway with ants, smaller ants in that driveway. So I was wondering, I've done things like what the previous caller had said, tarot, and then I looked at home remedies of doing boiling water and things like that. But they just keep on persisting. So,
Marcus, what do they look like? I mean, are they just all over the sidewalk or the drive, or are they making big mounds in your lawn? Or
no, they're really in the driveway. They're making huge sand piles in my driveway.
Oh, okay.
And they're pretty small, but they look like pretty standard ants, but. I was wondering if there were any other solutions that you might have.
Okay. I mean, in a case like this, there's a number of different ant species that could be possibility, but something like pavement ants would be one of my top considerations. And a lot of these ants build these small mounds, and their nests may not go down that deep. Now, the problem with a driveway area, you know, if they are living, coming out of a crack between pavement or something like that, or even if it's a gravel driveway and it's really compacted, it's hard to get insecticide products or even hot boiling water to seep in because of the impervious surface. In general, though, if I have small ants like this, one of the top things I do is find an ant control product at the hardware store that, rather than being like an aerosol spray or a spritzer bottle, it's a liquid. And then we can mix it up in a bucket with some water so that we can pour it in and drench it in. And the thought is if we can get enough of that to soak in and get deep enough to knock out the colony, that often provides the best results. Otherwise, if it doesn't seep in very far and we use a small volume or we're just spraying the surface, you'll often quiet things down for a while because he killed off some of the workers, but the colony bounces back over time. And so a couple weeks later, you've got some more ant activity on the driveway.
So sort of carefully pouring that into those cracked areas. Eh?
Yeah, that's something I would try. It would depend if it's blacktop or something like that. That's going to be harder to get it to soak in. If it were, say, a gravel driveway or if there's a big enough crack that I can take maybe a metal rod or something and poke a channel down into the ground a little bit, that may help it soak in some more. But that would probably be the approach I would try.
Marcus, I hope that helps.
Sure. So it would be something that would be concentrated that I would just mix with some water and pour down there?
Yeah. And if you go to the hardware store and browse around, there's going to be a lot of different products, but look for one that controls ants. And if you read the fine print on the label, it says you can mix it up with water or it's a liquid form, something like that.
Because, I mean, my next option was napalm. So, I mean, I was out of the wits end. So thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, and we'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Do you have an insect that's bothering you, or maybe you just have a general question about a particular insect. Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Matt in Wausau emailed to say he's seen a drop in insects in his area. At least it seems so to him. Have there been any studies that confirm sort of maybe nationwide or worldwide a drop in insects? And yeah, we've been hearing more and more of those kinds of reports.
Yeah, and this is something you could almost have an entire show on sometime. The general notion at the moment is there's lots of rumblings along these lines, lots of kind of anecdotal reports coming in to me and colleagues both in the state and around the country that there don't seem to be as many insects. Now, the tough thing is being able to get the data to actually definitively show
yeah.
that. There have been a few studies in the last couple of years. There's a very famous one from Europe. It was in part of Germany, if I remember correctly. And essentially, this entomology group there collected insects over the course of years and really decades and was able to document the mass and number of these. And so they're a group that actually had enough of this data to show that these declines are happening. One of the commonest stories I get from folks is what I would refer to as kind of the windshield effect. And that is you drive from southern Wisconsin to the North Woods, and back in the 40s or 50s or 60s, you'd have to stop and squeegee your windshield, you know, once or twice on the trip up. And now, folks, you really don't have to do that. So there's this kind of anecdotal evidence out there, and we can see it, but to actually get that study done to definitively say it, that's kind of the next step that we needed. Now, when you think about what's going on, I do have a strong suspicion there probably are these declines. I mean, we always get year-to-year variations in insects.
Sure.
Weather and other things. But if you look at the last, you know, 100 or 200 years in our area, we've done a lot of things, deforestation, changing things to farmland, things like light pollution, increase in impervious surfaces. That's going to have impacts on all these different insects. And so it doesn't surprise me that there may be these declines going on in the background. But again, it's very hard to get that data to actually show that.
Let's take another call and go to Kayla in Rhinelander. Hi, Kayla.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
So I've recently started to indulge in the world of succulents for my houseplants. And I got this one for Christmas, and it had some large-looking gnats in it. I ended up repotting all of the succulents, and they have so far not shown back up. But I'm just wondering what I can do to keep those gnats away, to keep any other pests from coming with these new succulents that I brought in my house.
Okay. So when it comes to gnats and houseplants, the first thing that comes to mind is what we'd call a fungus gnat or a dark-winged fungus gnat. They're these small, they're larger than a fruit fly, but relatively small flies with dark wings, delicate legs, and they just kind of flutter around. And they can be very commonly associated with houseplants. And the story with these is they themselves really aren't hurting the houseplants. They're primarily a nuisance. But the larval stage, which are these little whitish worms, maybe a quarter of an inch long with a black head on them and no legs, they live down in the soil. And they're associated with decaying organic matter, rich soil, and things like that. So they're really living and feeding in the soil, not going to hurt the plants. But when they emerge as the adult stage, they flutter around, they're a nuisance, they go to the windows, that sort of thing. So that's what I suspect you're dealing with. The story with these is they need that damp conditions and decaying organic materials to feed on. So a couple things you can do. If it's possible to water less frequently, really let that soil kind of dry out between waterings, that can make conditions that are inhospitable to these little fungus gnats. Also doing a good job when leaves and things like that fall off the plant and land on the soil surface, pick those up. If those sit there and decompose, that can be another food source for them. So we're getting rid of some of their food like that. Another thing you can do, if you go to the hardware store garden center, you can buy these yellow or blue sticky card traps specifically sold for houseplants, and you can put those up in the area. Those can help catch some of the adults. They're attracted to the colors a bit. If you use it as your only control method, it's probably not going to work in the long run, but a combination of watering less frequently, using the sticky cards to help siphon some of those adults off the population can be very helpful. I will say, just from own experience, I have some succulents in my office, and I picked up some new ones, and sure enough, fungus gnats in there. And so over the last month and a half, I've watered a lot less, used some of those sticky card traps, and I've got them almost on their way out. So it can be very effective if you can, the plants can tolerate less water.
Kayla, can you do that?
Yeah, I think that would be very possible.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Let's try Kathy in Madison. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. I've got a bug that looks like a beetle to me. It's got a hard top on it. It's dark colored. I'm low vision. I'm legally blind.
Okay.
So it's hard for me to describe it to you. And my husband has a phone that he could take a picture of it if I could get an address to send it someplace. Because we had a fire in our house, and a lot of the house was exposed, or the backside of the house was exposed for about a month and a half before anything was really closed up. And it was in July. And now we've got these beetles that we see every day, at least three of them I put out outside.
If you want to, if he can take a photo and send it to WPR.org.
WPR. Okay.
And we do that right now.
I can't do this. No, I can't do this right now because he's not home right now. Is there a place later?
Yeah.
Another thing you could do, if you hop on the web and do a search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, that'll get you to my lab website, and I've got all my contact information on there in terms of how to send me digital images by email or how to send me some physical specimens. And if you can get me pictures or physical specimens, I can get back in touch with you and let you know exactly what they are and how to deal with that. So again, do an internet search for UW or Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Okay. Got that, Kev? All right. Thank you very much for calling. Is there a insect diagnostic lab at the University of Washington?
Pretty much every state does have some type of diagnostic lab. Sometimes they're harder to find on the web.
What often happens if you type UW, the first thing that comes up is University of Washington always. So that's why I like to get Wisconsin in so I can make sure it's coming to us.
Yeah. Otherwise, if you put in my name, PJ Leesch, LIESCH, in Insect Identification or Insect Diagnostic Lab or Wisconsin, you should be able to find my website. It usually pops up fairly readily in a Google search, and that'll have all the instructions on how to get a sample to me.
There you go, Kathy. Thank you for calling. Gail in Fish Creek, your turn. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have found that lavender, it still is really the best thing to be planting outside to deter bugs, because it deters scorpions, so it's doing bugs too. And I'm finding that the more I'm planting in some areas, I'm having less bug problems. So that helps. But then I did find out when I had a cedar home a long time ago that eucalyptus mulch around close by the house, at the border of the house, keeps the black ants away.
All right, so we've got lavender and eucalyptus mulch. What do you think, PJ?
Well, when you think of plants like lavender and eucalyptus mulch and things like that, and when you start thinking about essential oils that you can extract from those plants, there is some truth to it in that if you were to extract the essential oils, sometimes they have certain repellent properties for insects. Typically, though, I mean, if I'm looking at a house, rather than focusing my attention on a certain plant or a certain mulch, one of the best things that comes to my mind is physically tightening things up. That's one of the absolute best things you can do to keep insects from outside so that they don't get indoors. So those are things like using caulk, expanding insulation foam to seal up cracks and crevices along your foundation, good weather stripping, taking a peek at where the siding butts up against a door window. There's often gaps there around where a hose spigot comes out of a house. If you take a close peek, there's lots of nooks and crannies where insects can get in. And if those are sealed up, that's a non-chemical approach, and it can be very, very effective for all kinds of insects as well.
P.J. Leash, our guest today. He is director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of insects today with P.J. Leash of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's turn to Mike in Milwaukee next. Mike, thank you for calling.
Hi. What's the best remedy or product for common kitchen fruit flies?
Okay, so when it comes to fruit flies indoors, in theory, there are sprays that'll kill them. I mean, you can spray adult fruit flies with a mixture of soapy water, and it can kill them. There are traps. The point I want to make about those is that's really kind of a temporary fix that only gets rid of the adult fruit flies for the time being. The best strategy, in my opinion, is to find where the source is. In fruit flies, the larvae or the juvenile stage, these little pale worms, they need some type of damp organic material to feed on. And if we can find that and clean it up, that's your long-term solution. Otherwise, you're going to keep fighting this battle for a long period of time. So places that fruit fly larvae can be associated with indoors, and especially this time of the year where it's cooler, we don't have the possibility of them coming in from outdoors. Spoiled produce, it could be something in long-term storage, and people think of fruit fly and think it's got to be around the fruit bowl. Well, really a better name for them would be vinegar fly, any type of kind of fermentation smell mm-hmm. they can like. Even if you had, say, in theory, a glass of beer that sat there, you forgot it, and there's just a little bit in the bottom. I mean, they can go to things like that. If you have long-term vegetables in storage, sometimes folks keep, you know, squash or pumpkins or potatoes in the cool basement. If one of those started to go bad and you didn't realize it yet, that could breed a lot of them. If you had some spilled garbage, maybe outside the liner bag, but in the trash can, if that was kept damp, that's a possibility. Sometimes you might have some buildup of gunk in a drain or in a garbage disposal. That can be another source. And so if you can put your detective cap on and go around and try and find those sources and clean them up, that's going to be your best solution. Otherwise, you're going to continue to have, I suspect, this emergence of adults occurring again and again. So trying to find the source, that's going to be your main route to go.
Thanks, Mike, for that question. Let's go to Jim in Wausau. Jim, hello.
Yes, hello. I got a question about spraying apple trees and potato bugs.
Okay.
Is that 7-Dust? Would that help at all? Are you supposed to spray the ground underneath trees or not? Or are the bugs on the trees only or what?
Gosh, it would really depend on the particular type of insect that you're trying to target.
What are you looking for there, Jim? Do you know the insect?
No. The bugs, quite a bit on the apples sometimes,
Okay.
So typically when I think of our top fruit pests on apples, things like codling moth and plum curculio and some of the other things, we really won't get help by applying it to the ground. Another thing is with the dust form. I'd be reluctant to use that on something like an apple tree. The reason for that is that dust could potentially be picked up by pollinators because, pollen and this dust, they're both fine powders, and it could potentially impact pollinators. If you know the exact insect pest you're dealing with apples, and that helps you know the timing of when to spray, there are fruit tree sprays. You'd essentially apply it just onto the fruit, and that can provide some pretty good protection for the fruit itself.
So next spring, then, would Jim be looking for those insects and maybe getting some photos to send to you or the insect themselves?
That could be helpful if you're keeping an eye out and see actual insects there. Otherwise, some of these may be active more at night, so you won't necessarily see them. There's a lot of cases where you kind of notice the damage after the fact. And so you might miss it 1 year, but if you know it's there, that helps prepare for the next. So one thing to keep an eye out for, if you do notice the damage on the apples, that can often be an important clue to figuring out what insect did it. And so if you have some, you can send me a box of apples, I can look at them for the damage, or if you take some pictures, that might be a helpful clue. Otherwise, if you you know, we're worried about your apples and you're not entirely sure what you have at this point. If you go with some of the general fruit tree sprays, they often have some guidance on there. And some of those are multi-purpose sprays for insects and some of the plant diseases on apples. So that could be something you could consider and look into as well.
All right. There we go. Good luck, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Nancy in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So we had a curb. We have a wooden fence put up, and it hasn't been treated. It's treated wood, but it hasn't been painted since. So a carpenter bee got in there, and we used one of those little scopes with the video thing, and he's actually up in there. So do they stay over winter, and then how can I ask them to leave in the spring without killing them?
Yeah, so they do spend the winter in the nest like that, and not necessarily the adults, but you'll have inside their nest these little provision cells or little rooms, if you will, and that's where the larvae had been set up with enough food for them to go through their development, and then those would emerge the following year. So there, if you had an activity there, there's probably some juveniles in there that overwintered. In terms of getting them to leave, you know, you could certainly just let them leave on their own. After they've left, you know, maybe plug up that hole. In the grand scheme of things, what I think of in terms of preventing carpenter bee activity, a couple of things. You could consider treating the wood again, or if the wood is painted or sealed, you know, a big heavy varnish coating,
yeah,
something like that. If it's just a stain that changes the color, that's not going to help. You need to physically seal the wood, and that can often dissuade them from tunneling back in and making new nests the following year.
All right. Does that help, Nancy?
It does. I'll watch for them in springtime, and hopefully they'll all just go out about their merry way.
All right. There you go. Thank you for calling. Kurt in South Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Very interesting program. I had a question on, with all the farmers using all the pesticides on their fields for like Roundup, so there's millions of acres without the weeds that used to be there. Could that be part of the butterflies, the insects, and the what seems to be a lower population?
Yeah, so that's a really good point, and a lot of folks are looking at that. And when you think of, you know, a farmer's field, we may have to use pesticides in those situations to deal with a given insect. And if you're using an insecticide, you know, that, of course, is going to have the potential to impact other insects in the area. So that's kind of a direct impact. But also, as you alluded to, we can have this indirect effect. So if we have Roundup-ready crops or some of these crops that are resistant to other herbicides, the herbicides themselves may not have a direct lethal effect on insects. But if that is getting rid of weeds in the area, and to us we might call it a weed, but if it's a flowering plant to a pollinating insect, that may be breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so if those plants are disappearing in large numbers, that's probably going to have some kind of impact on those local insects. So that type of human land use change is being looked at as potentially one of the contributing factors to overall suspected insect declines.
Interesting. All right. Thank you, Kurt, for calling. Mark contacted us to say that in recent years, his horseradish crop has been devastated by flea beetles. Can you recommend an organic or less desirable, a non-organic spray to control these pests?
Sure. So it depends a little bit in a case like this, you know, how big of a area we're talking about. If you've got a small garden, you know, the organic options may be more feasible. Along those lines, there's products out there like pyrethrins that are a natural plant extract. They are organic. They can work against flea beetles and other insects. The caveat is those products tend to break down very, very rapidly in sunlight and UV light and things like that. And so you spray today and, you know, day or two later, the product is basically gone and not working.
Yeah.
So if you want to go that route, you often have to kind of be diligent and keep on top of things. You might have to spray multiple times. So that's the caveat with that, but it can be done. There are some very closely related products that are from the same general group. They work in the same way, but they're a synthetic version. So they work against the intact nerves in the same way. These would be the pyrethroids, so bifenthrin, cyfluthrin, deltamethrin, and so on. You can find these at garden centers and things like that. One of the advantages of these is they last longer. before they're broken down. They might last 5 or 7 days or 10 days. And so you can have it work the same way. It's technically not organic, but that may be another consideration that you could try.
Hmm. Ken in Mundelein, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, hi. I had a question. My wife wants to set up either a mason bee or leafcutter bee house colony kind of thing in our yard. And I was wondering for our region, kind of like southeast Wisconsin, northeast Illinois, if there was a preference between mason bees and leafcutter leafcutter bees, and if you know their needs differ, because I know the mason guys need the mud and the leafcutter guys need heavy leaf stuff, and so I was wondering if there was a preference for our region.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't really say there's much of a preference. I mean, both could use our help. And one thing you can do, because they are both tube nesters, if you have holes or tubes of different sizes, you can easily have both potentially in your nest.
Oh, so you put those on a post or?
Yeah, if you Google bee house or bee hotel, you find them, you can put them on a post or affix them to a fence or something like that. But there's a lot of neat plans out there online.
Thanks, Ken, for calling. Appreciate it. And P.J. Leash, our guest, he's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today to take your insect questions. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or email us your question and or photo to ideas@WPR.org. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with P.J. So you stay with us. We'll be back soon. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects today with P.J. Leash, who directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. Questions for him, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you've got a photo of an insect you want to comment on, you can send it to ideas@WPR.org. And some callers on the line, PJ, so let's go to the phones and Gary in Madison next. Hi, Gary. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call. I live in an area where there's a high population or density of ear ticks. I have a dog that has tested positive. I've got two kids. It seems that my wife can't walk to the garden or to the mailbox without having a tick on her, whereas I might get one on me during the summer. I clean up the leaves and the debris as much as possible. Just didn't know if there was anything more I could do to help keep the population down. Hang up and listen.
Yeah, yep. just at least in your lawn area, you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple thoughts in a case like this. If you are in a heavy tick area, I'd always encourage the just general personal protection. Long pants, you can tuck them into socks, things like that. Just you have a physical clothing barrier. You can get clothing treatments with things like permethrin. You can actually treat your clothes. It's going to have repellent properties. It can also kill the ticks if they contact it long enough. So if you have your favorite pair of gardening pants or hiking boots or gardening boots, something like that, you could consider purchasing a bottle of this stuff, and most outdoor stores will have it. REI and Gander and places like that and Bass Pro Shop. You can find it. And usually a bottle is enough to treat a couple garments. And sometimes you can actually buy outdoor clothing already treated with the stuff. It's basically some technology originally designed for the military. And that's one really good way for you to have personal protection. Otherwise, repellents like DEET and Picaridin and others can be effective as well whenever you're going to be spending time outdoors. Now, in terms of looking for things to do in your yard, I typically don't think of ticks doing very well out in a typical home lawn. Where it's open, there's sunny, if the grass is relatively short, it's fairly dry, there's not as much humidity there. Instead, I think of them as being more of an edge creature. And what I mean by that is if you have your lawn butt up against a woodlot area, they're probably coming from the woodlot, and they might make it into your yard a little bit, but they're probably not going to survive very well in your lawn. And so often what we can do is, rather than having to use an insecticide on your entire lawn, you can focus your attention and treat or consider treating a band with a liquid insecticide right on the edge of your yard where the lawn butts up against the wooded area, the trees. You could also potentially have a mulch bed in those areas because they're not going to do as well in areas like that. And so there are some things we can do just at the edge of our yard that will hopefully prevent them from coming into our yard as much. So the liquid insecticide treatments. One other thing that you could consider, there are devices out there called tick tubes. And if you just hop online and Google search tick tubes, you'll be able to find them. It's essentially a cardboard tube with some cotton balls in there that have been treated with that permethrin ingredient. And we put these out for areas where rodents like mice will grab the cotton balls to use as nesting material. And it's treated. So if there are ticks on the mice, those ticks get killed off. And so that may be another consideration for your yard.
Couple of things to think about there, Gary. Thank you so much for calling. And Tony in Milwaukee, hello to you.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
So I was curious to where the bed bugs came from, like their original origin. I know, like, cockroaches and stuff came from, like, South America, and that through migration from people and, you know, products and ships and that, they kind of came here too. But unfortunately, I've noticed a lot more bed bug activity in the past couple of years.
Yeah, bed bugs.
Yeah. So, interesting story here, and it is somewhat similar to some of the roaches. And as you just mentioned, some of our roaches are really more tropical creatures that came here from the southern hemisphere, Africa and South America in some cases and things like that. With the bed bugs, they originated in kind of the Mediterranean region. And the thought is that when early humans thousands of years ago started living in some of the caves there, that's probably where the association started. And originally, bed bugs fed on bats. And if you go to parts of Eastern Europe, there's still a population of bed bugs that are in people's houses, but they still feed on bats in the attic. They don't like human blood. So at some point, though, the bed bugs figured out, rather than feeding on bats, if these humans are living in this cave long term, we can adapt and feed on that. And so that's kind of how the story went. So that would have been thousands of years ago. And then as humans moved around the globe with trade and, you know, European settlers came to North America, bed bugs came with them. Interestingly, right after World War II, with things like DDT, that almost got rid of bed bugs. During the 50s and 60s and 70s, if you were an entomologist and had a bed bug case, that was something rather unique and interesting, because during that time period, we just didn't see them. In about the last 20 or so years since the 90s, bed bugs have really made a global resurgence because of some of the resistance to some of the pesticide products that can be used. And so it's spread out from other spots on the globe, typically moving with like business travelers, got into the U.S. often in larger cities where you have a nearby international airport. And then within the span of a decade or so of showing up in the U.S., they had spread to all the states. You can find them in small towns. But to get back to the heart of your story, they probably started somewhere around the Mediterranean or Middle East region.
There we go, Tony. Thanks for that call. Interesting. Where they got going. Josh in Glidden, your turn. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Just a comment I'd like to make in regard to the gentleman who was having the tick issue. My wife and I live out in the country, and we had a bad tick issue. My wife now got lines, and it was to the point where there'd be two or three of them waiting for us on our front door each morning. So what we ended up doing is getting chickens, and not guinea hens, just regular chickens, you know, a mixed variety. And now, as long as we're within the confines of where the chickens roam, we don't get one tick.
Interesting observation. Yeah, I've heard a little bit about that. Chickens and other birds might feed on ticks to a certain extent. So it sounds like it's helping out in cases like this. In a lot of cases, you know, folks maybe just can't keep chickens in their yard. So my kind of go-to is the personal protection and modifying our yard and things like that. But it definitely sounds like the chickens are at least helping you out in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Josh. Appreciate it. On to Steve in Mount Pleasant. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Hey, good. Nice listening to you. Just got a question because I've grown up in northern Illinois, and I never really had a problem with chiggers. And I've been out in the woods a lot, and I remember I've been down to Kentucky. I had gotten chiggers down there, and I never really bad thing about those is you never know you have them until afterwards, you know. And I just recently in this year I've gotten bites that appear in Mount Pleasant that appear to be chigger bites. You know, I've gotten them on my legs and ankles from walking through the grass, taller grass, and I don't know. My question is, are chiggers moving further north? Have they always been in the area, or is it, or could it possibly be something besides chiggers?
Yeah.
So that is a good question. The short story is that we do have chiggers around, from my experience, so they don't tend to be very common. Sometimes they can be very spotty, and if you're in one spot, wandering around in a bramble patch, you maybe bump into them. But if you go farther to the south, they seem to be much, much more common. So in short, they are around, but it's not all that common to actually bump into them in Wisconsin.
So you're the lucky one, Steve. Or could they be something else? Could he have something else?
Well, it's possible. Outdoors, you know, there's a short list of things you can bump into that will bite, but it's often hard to look just at the bites and figure out what caused it. There are a few other mites you could potentially bump into. You know, if you've been wandering around outdoors, though, especially if it's a brambly area, chiggers are a definite possibility.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Let's go to Patrick in Milwaukee next. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I'm building a timber frame structure on the west side of the state in Iowa County, made of white oak. And in a couple of the timbers that are already in the frame, I'm experiencing some, boring beetles. I generally treat all the timbers with a water solution of borax before I put the timbers into the frame. And these couple of timbers, this has been really tough in getting the beetles out of there. And I'm just wondering, is there anything I can do other than that? Or
yeah, sure.
Wait them out? Or
yeah, kind of. I'd say a combination of those two, and it sounds like you've definitely done your research and you're doing the right thing with the borate-based product that you mix up with liquid. The caveat is that can only wick in so far into that wood, and that's going to be influenced by wood moisture content and other factors, but that's kind of a long-term protection of the wood. What can happen, though, if there are insects that had already been in the wood and they were maybe deeper in the wood than what the borate product soaked into, they may still work their way out. It's very, very unlikely, though, that they would reproduce and then get another batch going into the woods. So with the borate-based product, that's long-term protection. Again, if you just kind of wait it out, I would suspect things will kind of leave the log and then new things aren't going to be getting in and starting a new infestation.
There you go. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it. Robert emailed to ask about the purpose of the phantom crane fly.
That's an interesting question. I haven't thought much about.
Yeah, talk about that.
So phantom crane flies, I've only seen myself probably a couple times in my career. They're these, if you're familiar with a crane fly, which look like the gigantic mosquitoes, it's a somewhat close related family, although phantom crane flies have this very cool appearance, very, very distinctive. They are black and white. There's nothing else that really looks like them. I tend to encounter them when I have seen them near often marshy wooded areas.
Okay, hence the name, probably.
Yeah. They're just trying to do their thing and find a mate and reproduce. I would say that's kind of their, purpose of what they're doing. But they're overall just really cool insects to bump into. If you hop online, I encourage you to do an image search for phantom crane fly, because, as I said, they're really quite rare in Wisconsin and surrounding states. And if you see them, they're just cool insects to look at.
And do they create problems for cranes, or
as far as I know, I don't think they really do anything bad. They don't bite, they don't harm animals, anything like that. When I have encountered them, it's been a lone individual, and they just kind of fly around clumsily, a little bit like a phantom, I suppose, or a ghost, just these clumsy, delicate flyers. and they just kind of go about their business, but really cool insects to see.
And how long are they, roughly?
They're good size. The leg span on them, probably an inch and a half.
All right.
So, again, if you know what a crane fly is, it looks like a big, skinny-legged mosquito. These are like that. The legs are a little bit thicker, but some distinct black and white alternating bands on the legs and body.
You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments. PJ, early in the show, I mentioned that you were going to talk with us a little bit about some of the trends you saw in the insect world last year. And you've got a list of about 10 different, everything from mosquitoes to orb weaver spiders. So let's talk about a couple of those trends.
Sure. So every year I've got to do some annual reporting, and I'm summarizing what I saw in the last year, and it's fun to just go through and kind of look at what are the top things that stood out to me. And so I typically come up with an article that I'm working on at the moment. But when I look at some of the big stories, it was a tough choice, but I put mosquitoes at number one spot for the year. When I look at the reports and calls I was getting, I mean, we had very high mosquito pressure, and specifically our floodwater mosquitoes early in the summer around Memorial Day weekend. I'm sorry if I'm bringing up bad memories for folks, but they were bad then. And then interestingly, when we had that unprecedented rainfall in end of August and early September, we had another huge batch of those, which was unusual for that time of the year. Typically, I'm expecting mosquitoes to be kind of quieting down for the most part. And I had just a flood of emails, and it was essentially about the southern two-thirds of the state seemed to be inundated with those floodwater mosquito species, like Aedes vexans were very, very common at the time. And so because of all those mosquitoes, I put them on the top spot of my list for last year.
Well, we'll get to some other insects on the list. Mike in Rhinelander, though, has a question. Mike, hello.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Yeah, I've got a 60-year-old barn with solid or full log floor joists, and I've noticed now when I walk in under there, sometimes I'll see little sawdust piles on sitting up on the log joists, and some of the logs have bark on them still, but it's a 60-year-old, relatively dry log. Wondering what they might be, and if there's a good organic way to get rid of them.
Powder post beetles, maybe, huh?
Yeah, that's what I think they are, Larry. So there's some different types of beetles called powder post beetles, and out in the woods, these are associated with dead trees. Sometimes, though, they can be associated with wood in buildings, and the commonest place I bump into them would be old barn beams. And so these beetles, the larvae are living in the wood. The larvae basically have to push out some of the sawdust, or when the adults come out, they're pushing out the sawdust. It's often a very fine, kind of similar to talc powder, and you get these little piles, and sometimes it sticks on those wood beams. And with that description, that's what I think you're dealing with. In terms of what you would do in a case like this, and we talked about this a couple callers ago with the wood log construction he was making, we would use a borate-based wood preservative. And the thought is you either paint that on or use a paint roller and kind of roll it on, or in some cases spray it on. That's going to wick into the wood a little bit and serve as a long-term protectant. The borate acts as a stomach poison for insects that are feeding in that area. So that's how we'd go about dealing with it.
So spray it on or roll it on. And the borate material, do you just go out and buy a can of borax, or do you?
Well, there's specific products. They're often sold by like log cabin home supply companies.
Okay.
Some of the products I can think of off the top of my head, Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R is one of them. There's also a Boracare, B-O-R-A-C-A-R-E is another one. So if you're really looking for that, maybe hop online, do some searching, or look up in the Yellow Pages log cabin supply companies, and they're often the types of places that would sell those types of products.
There you go, Mike. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to your trend list again. You had mosquitoes at the top of the list, but second?
I had monarch butterflies as number two. Last year was probably one of the best monarch years I can remember. Everywhere you went around, yeah. I mean, campus here, you'd stop by a patch of flowers and there'd be five, six of them hanging yeah. out. And it wasn't just observations in Madison. I would chat and get emails from folks from around the state. It seemed to be a very, very good year. Will that translate in an overall bump in monarch numbers? It's too early to tell at this point. Often what they do, so the monarchs, they migrate down to Mexico. Folks down in Mexico can estimate the area and density of overwintering monarchs and get a population estimate, and that often comes out in February or March. So I suspect in the next month, month and a half, we'll have a better idea of how they're doing. But from reports I had last year, it was a great monarch here in Wisconsin.
Well, at least listeners to Wisconsin Public Radio, a lot of people are getting plants out there that will attract them and help them live. So
yeah.
maybe it's a good thing.
That is, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, number three, army worms.
Yeah, so army worms are something that's usually around in low numbers in a lot of cases, but this is an insect that overwinters in the southern states. It's too cold for it here, and they essentially get blown in or fly up here with the jet stream. And so it's a little bit of a lottery in a given year. Do we get a lot of them? Yeah. Do we get a little? They get up here early and get a good start, you can get some big populations. And so last year, around the state in about the third week of July, I had phone call after phone call of army worms. And the reason they get the name of army worms is they can eat everything in a crop field. It could be a corn or a wheat field, and then they will march across the road by the tens or hundreds of thousands to get to the next crop field. Or in some cases, they might march across the road and get to a home lawn and start eating your lawn. And so this was something that kind of popped up out of the blue around the state, a flood of reports, and then about 2 weeks later, it was done and gone. And it hadn't happened, but I had lots and lots of army worm calls in about third week of July last year.
Sawflies, number four?
So there's a lot of different species of sawflies, but some of them that popped up that were unusual in very, very high numbers, there's a species of sawfly associated with things like creeping jenny, Lysimachia plants, but also dogwood sawfly had a really good year. Lots and lots of reports of those. So that came in at number four on my list.
And, well, what the heck? Let's go to number five. Sphinx moths.
Sphinx moths. So in particular, one of them that stood out to me was the white line sphinx moth. And these are big hornworm caterpillars. They were exceedingly common last year. One thing that happened that I've only read about in the books before, these can pop up in huge numbers like the army worms. And they popped up in cases like that in crop fields. The good news is they weren't damaging the crops. They were feeding on weeds in the farm field. If you're a farmer, though, you're probably a little bit nervous if you've got tens or hundreds of thousands of these big caterpillars in your field. But folks spotted them marching across roads by the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. And if you remember to last summer, in months like August, lots of the adult white-lined sphinx moth hovering at flowers in yards. So if you remember seeing those, we're talking about the caterpillar stage was very abundant too.
So there's the top five. There were five more, but we're going to have to save those for another show. PJ, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being with us today. Really appreciate it. You're back on March 20th, and we'll do this all over again. P.J. Leash directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab in the Department of Entomology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Always great to have him with us. He's back March 20th. Tomorrow at 11, we talk to New York Times bestselling author Tim Johnson about his brand new thriller. It's called The Current. And then an update on what's happening with cameras these days. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.